call this meeting to order at 9:03. If everybody would rise for the invocation and the pledge to the flag. Dear Lord, thank you for allowing us to meet today and come together for the city of Kirby. Please be with us and the military, the police, fire, and first responders, and our city employees. Amen.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Please be seated. The city of Kirby is dedicated to delivering excellent municipal services to our community in a fiscal responsible manner. And this morning we have one. Sorry, Ted.
Councilmember Grant.
Here.
Councilmember Apodaca.
Here.
Councilmember Salazar.
Here.
Councilmember Breyer.
Here.
Councilmember Street.
Here.
Councilmember Martin.
Here.
Mayor Aldrich.
Here.
This morning we have one person signed up to speak, Dolores Darby.
Good morning. I met somebody in the parking lot. I didn't know that my city council members could be so human and chipper. First I'd like to thank everybody here who has military family members who served in the military. Happy Armed Forces Day. I think it's something that we all should honor, the sacrifices and the service of the people here in the city that have done so. I'd also like to thank the volunteers. I was able to see the Zoning Commission in action. So I'd like to go out of my way to thank the paid employees and the people who volunteer for our various committees, city council, police, for their service. I know that y'all hear the negative and the complaints before you hear the positives, if rarely that. So thank you very much. Patty has heard some, I'm sure, some things in her time. Now, I'm here because I want to speak out against the variance that was granted at the Zoning Committee for a property on Old Seguin Road. I live in one of the houses that borders that across from the middle school, and I was very surprised that a variance was granted before it felt like it was granted before any real introspection was put into it. It went from a C1 to a C2 on that particular lot of land. It does not qualify for C2 on just the size. The lady who owned that plot of land didn't know about the drainage issue or what drainage she would have to be putting in, like flood abatement. But the variance was pushed through without those plans in front, as opposed to a gentleman who came in and had all of his ducks in a row concerning what he was going to do with his property, how he was going to address the flooding, everything. He knew everything. So I understand that there are variances granted, but I would like to know, or I would like to see that variances not be granted until due diligence is put into and shown to the Zoning Committee and to the City Council exactly what has to be done in order to develop these properties. Speaking with my neighbors, I did kind of blindside them about this meeting today, and a lot of them had plans, but I didn't get a single, gosh, we're happy about this going in. They were all concerned about the flooding. Everybody knows that we need growth. We want business. We want things. We want a bigger tax base, but we're really worried about the the flooding issue. And I would like if City Council could give a little bit more, you know, look into how variances are granted and what is the criteria for variance to be granted when it changes the zoning designation. Thank you.
We will move on to 6A, presentation by city attorney and discussion on city charter, council roles and responsibilities, parliamentarian procedure, open meetings act, public information act, typical actions, competitive bidding rules, conflict of interest, and city-related boards and commissions. Mark Schnall, our city attorney, present.
Good morning, members of the council and citizens present. As Mayor Aldrich has said, I am Mark Schnall. I am the city attorney. I've done city attorney work for the city of Kirby since 1989 and have been city attorney since 2003. That's a long time, in case anyone wasn't counting. And so this is a presentation where I encourage anyone on the council who has questions to ask the question when it comes to mind, as long as it's relevant to what I'm talking about. And we'll have an opportunity at the end, if I didn't say something that you wanted to ask about, as long as it's germane to the agenda item wording, we can entertain those questions as well. But as I go on this presentation, please feel free to, you know, raise your hand or just speak up if you have a question or want a clarification on something. So I start in Kirby on this presentation by saying Kirby's a home rule city, and it's governed by its charter. 2 weeks ago, the citizens voted on 15 amendments to the charter. Every single amendment was adopted by a vote of at least 70%. That's remarkable. On the same day, the city of San Antonio had an election on a very controversial item that was decided by less than 51 to 49. So the citizens were overwhelmingly in support of the recommendations from your Charter Commission and the action of the City Council to get those recommendations on the ballot. The City Charter covers matters such as how many people sit on the City Council, 7. The quorum for council meetings, 4. The appointment and role of the City Manager, local election rules, financial administration matters, and much more. As a home rule city, Kirby has much more flexibility in what actions it can take than a general law city, because a home rule city cannot take action that is contrary to state law, but usually can take action if state law is silent on the subject. The city manager is the chief administrative officer of the city, and essentially is also the chief operating officer of the city. The city manager is the only employee of the city hired by the city council. And so if a council member has an issue or a concern about a personnel matter involving some other employee, your first stop should be to the city manager. It would be somewhat undermining the city manager's authority and creating potential liability if city council members got directly involved in personnel issues on their own. That's why we have a city manager with that responsibility. The city manager's powers are set out in section 3.01 of the charter. They include the proper administration of the city, appointing, supervising, and when necessary, removing department heads, keeping city council informed as to the financial condition and future needs of the city, among other things. The City Council is dealt with in Article 2 of the City Charter. Article 4 covers your elections. In Section 2.01, the Council is set up to be composed of the Mayor and 6 Council members with staggered 2-year terms. The quorum, as I mentioned a minute ago, for the meeting of the City Council is 4, but the Charter also provides that except for matters relating to filling vacancies, all action of the City Council must be adopted by the affirmative vote of 4 or more members of the City Council. Certain actions, one, for example, being overruling a recommendation of the Zoning Commission to deny a zoning change or special use permit, must be adopted by vote of at least 6 members of the City Council. It takes a supermajority to take those actions. I think Ms. Vernon or staff have put in front of you a one-page list of something that you may not be able to see this, but looks like this, titled Robert's Rules Abbreviated. This is a list derived from Robert's Rules of Order on typical motions that might be made at a City Council meeting or at any meeting of a governing body or a board. The list shows a little bit of how motions would be worded, whether they can be debated, and what vote, whether it's a majority vote or a supermajority vote, is required for adoption of a motion under Robert's rules. For my part, rather than just reading off of this, I wanted to cover a few things that I thought have come up in the various City Council meetings that I've attended and participated in over the years. As the Open Meetings Act requires that for action to be taken, your agenda has to specify action, at least specify in some action word that action is possible. But in addition to the agenda wording, there actually has to be a spoken motion from a member of the governing body that is made and seconded, and in some cases followed by discussion, in some cases immediately voted on. There should be only one motion pending at one time. So if Mr. Martin makes a motion to deny something and it gets seconded, that motion needs to be decided before Mr. Salazar's motion to do something else or Ms. Apodaca's motion to do a third thing. Each motion that's made and seconded needs to be disposed of or amended and then disposed of before a new main motion is brought before the governing body. What I've found over the years is the following kinds of motion are typically made at a City Council meeting. The easy one is a motion to take action. A member of the governing body would say, I move to adopt ordinance number such and such, authorizing the city to enter into a contract with some vendor for and specifying the purpose. Once that motion is seconded, there's discussion. When the discussion is completed, there's a vote. If no one seconds the motion fails or dies for lack of a second. The next common motion is a motion to amend. We heard that motion to enter into a contract and with a certain vendor, and then another member of the council during the discussion says, I move that the motion to enter into the contract with so-and-so for this purpose be amended to add an authorization for Mayor Aldridge to sign the contract. The amendment has to be germane to the motion, has to relate to the motion that's before you. The amendment needs to be seconded. The amendment is then debated and voted on, up or down. And then, after that motion is disposed of, either by agreeing to add the phrase about authorizing the mayor to sign the agreement or not, then the main motion is back up for discussion and action. Another motion that's often made is a motion to close debate. The actual wording in Robert's rules for that motion is, I move the previous question. But most people simply say, I move to call the question. And reasonable interpretation from a parliamentarian standpoint is that either motion is adequate to bring to the governing body or the board that action to call the question. The motion must be seconded, but it is not subject to debate or discussion or amendment. When you get a motion to close debate, everything stops until there's a vote. No discussion, no amendment, it's voted on. A motion to move or call the previous question must be adopted by a two-thirds vote of all council members present. So if there are all 7 of you present, that vote takes 5 yeses to be adopted to stop debate. And if that motion is adopted by that 5 votes, Then the debate is stopped, and the council needs to immediately move to vote on the motion. If the motion to call the question is not adopted, in other words, it gets just two or three votes or four votes, but not the five needed, then discussion on the main motion continues as before, and we just keep on going until there's that motion is disposed of. Another common motion is a motion to table. Robert's rule says that motion should be, I move to lay the question on the table. But again, it's often worded more simply, I move to table the motion. Like the motion to call the question, this motion is not subject to discussion or debate or amendment, but it has to be seconded and then is to be voted on immediately. A motion to table is adopted by a majority vote, so it takes four votes to adopt a motion to table. And if the motion to table is adopted, the consideration of the item at that meeting is over. The subject can be placed on a future agenda. Another typical motion is a motion to postpone. Very similar to a motion to table, but the motion to postpone is, I move to postpone the motion to the next regular meeting of the City Council or to a specific date that the Council is going to be meeting at. If seconded, a motion to postpone may be discussed. It may be amended. Someone might want to say, well, let's not do it at the next regular meeting. Let's do it at the next meeting, whether it's a regular meeting or a special meeting, for example. The motion to postpone, like the motion to table, is adopted only by a majority. It doesn't need a supermajority of five or more votes. And if adopted, the motion to postpone is placed on the agenda in accordance with the wording of the motion, whether it's the next regular meeting, the next special meeting, something along those lines. And then the last motion I wanted to cover is a little bit more dramatic. It's a motion to kill the main motion. And the wording for that motion is, I move to postpone the motion indefinitely. If seconded, this motion may be discussed, but it may not be amended. You're either going to kill this or you're not going to kill it. A motion to postpone indefinitely is adopted by a majority vote. And if adopted, the matter is not to come back. That ends that motion essentially forever. Way people get around that is to find another motion that's close to it and deals with it. But the motion to postpone indefinitely, I've only seen work once. A board I was on was debating changing the name of the organization. And the name had been used for about 95 years. And somebody wanted to change the name, to modernize the name. And someone else on the board said that he wanted to move that postpone the motion indefinitely, and it was adopted. And there's never been another debate on that board in the following 30 years or so to change the name of the organization. I referred earlier to the Open Meetings Act, and I want to spend a few minutes talking about the Open Meetings Act. And this may be directed most to our newest members, I think Ms. Street and Ms. Grider, because there's a training video. And if you haven't seen the training video from the Office of the Attorney General, please do so. The state law requires that be done within 90 days of your taking the oath of office as a member of the governing body. It's only about an hour long. And Patty can give you either the link or sometimes years ago when they first did it, they actually sent out DVDs to cities. You can certainly go to the Secretary of State's website and find it and watch it and then print a certificate of completion that should be turned into the city secretary.
Don't I need to redo that as well?
My position and the Office of the Attorney General seems to agree that once you do the video once, you do not have to do it each time you're elected or reelected. Anyone is certainly welcome to just watch it as a refresher. It's like chicken soup that can't hurt, but I would say that you're not required to take it but one time, to watch it one time. But please make sure that a certificate of completion is turned in to the city secretary. We've had, in another city I represent, there was an open records request for copies of those certificates. So make sure Patty has them. The notice of a meeting, this agenda, which there seem to be a few extra copies of, this agenda must include, as this does in the caption, the date and time and place of the meeting. Saturday, May 15, 2021, 9 o'clock a.m., City Council Chamber, 112 Bauman, Kirby, Texas. If that information is not on the agenda, then you're not going to have a meeting. And the agenda does need to include, in addition to that basic time, place, and date information, the subject of every item that is going to be addressed at the meeting. If someone wants to talk about something that's not on the agenda, they can do so, as the citizen who spoke a few minutes ago did. They can talk about anything they want, whether it's an issue on their street, whether it's an upcoming event, whether it's a variance that they don't want the council to grant next week. All of that can be spoken to at this meeting during Citizens to be Heard. At the meeting next Thursday night, there'll be a public hearing on the variance that was discussed in Citizens to be Heard this evening. And so citizens, whether it's Ms. Darby or others, will be able to come and let the council know what their view is on the item before you during the public hearing. In Citizens to be Heard, the most important advice I give city councils is one word: listen. That's the purpose of Citizens to be Heard, for y'all to listen to what's on the mind of your constituents and other people who are interested in the affairs of the city. Answers should be limited. They can include only two things: facts or policy. There should not be a debate. Often the presiding officer, the mayor, will refer a citizen to staff to follow up on something, or will ask staff to follow up with the citizen at a later time. My recommendation is that only the mayor should respond for the governing body during Citizens to be Heard, and only the city manager, or in some cases the city secretary, for staff. There may not be, under the statute, discussion by the city council on the merits of what was discussed. You can briefly discuss whether to place the item on a future agenda. There cannot be a motion to do that. There can simply be a discussion. Ms. Grider could say, I'd like to have that on the next agenda. And the mayor will say, thank you, and we'll see about that, or words to that effect. There should not even be extended discussion about that. But that is the only kind of discussion there might be. You may have heard, and in the video they have a little thing about walking quorums. This is a very somewhat complicated issue that was in the federal court system about a year and a half ago, about a walking quorum. The Open Meetings Act says that it's a violation to participate in a walking quorum. And a walking quorum violation occurs when one member of the governing body knowingly engages in at least one communication among a series of communications that each occur outside of a meeting concerning an issue that's before the governing body, and in which the members engaging in individual communications constitute fewer than a quorum, but the total of those communications do constitute a quorum. One councilman talking to another councilman, not a problem. But if both of those council members then talk to a third and fourth council member, all four have committed a walking quorum violation of the Open Meetings Act. And there's a presumption of sorts that when members start that process of conversation, that they know there's a risk that it could involve, ultimately, discussions outside of a meeting with a quorum. The communication that starts the walking quorum can be a face-to-face discussion, it can be a telephone call, it can be an email, it can be a social media posting on Facebook or Nextdoor. And in one case, the walking quorum was based on the, a walking quorum was alleged by a district attorney's office in Texas based upon emails among a majority of a city council about when to hold a special meeting. Not about the subject, just when to hold the meeting. And that was a court case. It was ultimately dismissed. But there were a lot of nervous council people in a small town because of that action. The short message is, do not discuss city business with other members of the city council in any way or format unless you are in this room during a properly noticed and conducted meeting of the city council like this one. You can have closed sessions of the city council. They're sometimes called executive sessions. The statute permits those in specific situations, consultations with attorney, personnel matters, some but not all real estate matters, some but not all economic development matters, and security matters. Those are the ones that are most typically the reasons for having a executive or closed session by a city council. Discussions in executive session should be considered confidential. Revealing discussions in an executive session can be harmful to the city. Ordinarily, attorney-client confidential communications are confidential. They are privileged. They are not protected. They are protected from being revealed. So advice I give to a city council in a closed session is confidential, privileged, cannot be discovered by someone else. But if a member of the governing body then talks about that legal advice outside of the executive session and in public, you've lost the attorney-client privilege to everybody for everything on that subject. And that, I hope everyone understands, would be very detrimental to the legal position of the city. Next paragraph, okay? The other thing that comes up in executive sessions, I will answer Ms. Vernon's question in a moment, but one of the other things that does come up in executive session are personnel matters, and often sensitive personnel matters, where if revealed, the information discussed in executive session not only could be detrimental to the city, but could be embarrassing and troubling to an employee and would be a violation of law, perhaps the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, or other things, and again, confidentiality. If the council discusses the potential value of real estate that it is considering buying or selling, and then the information about what the city is willing to pay or willing to accept in that real estate transaction gets out, well, the city's ability in negotiating posture is totally compromised. Again, confidentiality. The bottom line is that revealing content of discussions in executive session will hurt the city's position. And then, generally speaking, in addition to anything discussed in a closed session being considered and treated as confidential, you should also consider the non-public parts of your council packets and documents that you receive in executive session or other documents you may receive separately as members of the governing body. Presume they're confidential unless you're told otherwise. Again, as the members of the governing body, you're going to be getting information which is not readily available to the public for a reason, and we'll get to what the public can get access to in a few minutes. In executive session, no action may be taken. Action must be taken in an open session like this. So in the executive session, you can discuss whether to make an offer to buy a piece of property on Ben Zingelman, but you don't vote on whether to make an offer on that piece of property. The vote on the offer or the vote on authorizing staff to pursue more information or other things about that property, the vote is made in the open session. executive sessions should not be a regular thing. I have in my notes they should be rare, but I think that's not fair of a statement really to make. But they should be used when it's necessary. But for the most part, most of what you are going to be dealing with and discussing and acting on is public information, and that's fine. Mr. Grant.
Yes, you said one of the things that you said, consultation. Could you kind of give some examples of what when you go into executive session for consultation?
If the city's involved in litigation, then the attorney handling the litigation may want to brief the council in a closed session on the status of the litigation, on a potential settlement of the litigation, on the strategy being imposed or being taken in the litigation. Similarly, the city might get a complaint about something where there was an allegation about a violation of law, or the city may want, or a member of the governing body may want, an interpretation of a state statute. Those are the kinds of things that are typically discussed under the attorney-client privilege and the attorney-client exception to the public to the Open Meetings Act. This is one of the areas where the state statute is very strict. So there may be a recording of an executive session, and if there is a recording of the executive session, it is a violation of state law to release that recording unless a judge orders it released. There can also be, in lieu of a recording, what's called a certified agenda. Certified agenda is prepared by the city secretary and is signed by the mayor or the city manager, typically the mayor, that certifies what the executive session was about, whether any action was taken. The certified agenda is also confidential, may not be released unless a court orders release. The city I represented once received an open records request for the certified agenda. I submitted a letter to the Office of the Attorney General. I did not enclose a copy of the certified agenda because even to send it to the Attorney General might violate the law. So I wrote a letter that explained what was asked for, said that if you require me to provide it, I will provide it, so long as you assure me that it will not violate the Open Meetings Act if I provide it. And the Attorney General wrote a letter back saying, hold it, we don't want to see it either. That's a paraphrase of what they said. But essentially, they certainly supported the fact that that is a confidential document. The criminal penalty, if you participate in an improper closed session. I once had a city council member asked to have a closed session to discuss the business terms of a contract with a contractor and insisted that this council could do so. And I said no. I said in front of the whole council and the public present, no, you cannot go into an executive session to discuss the business terms of a contract. You can go into that session to get legal advice about the contract, but you cannot go into executive session to discuss the business terms. The penalty, if they had gone into that executive session and if it had been prosecuted by the district attorney's office, was a possible fine of between $100 and $500 and confinement in the county jail for 1 month to 6 months. Don't do it. If I'm here, I will do my utmost to make sure you don't, but make sure that if you're going to an executive session, the exact reason you're going in is on the record and that it fits into one of the stated, printed, statutory exceptions: attorney-client privilege, certain real estate matters, personnel matters, security matters, economic development matters. Those are the five that typically come up for a city council. The Open Meeting Act also means that although the mayor waited for folks to finish getting refreshments this morning, the mayor cannot call the meeting to order if there's no quorum. You have to have a quorum. As I mentioned earlier, four of the seven elected members of the governing body is a quorum in Kirby. If there's an error or a mistake on the agenda, you need to stop and get a legal opinion. If I'm not here, Ms. Vernon knows how to reach me on my cell phone. Some real situations. A city where I was assistant city attorney posted an agenda on Friday afternoon for a meeting on Wednesday. Did not put the time of the Wednesday meeting on the agenda. That city council had historically, for the previous 20 years, always met on, I think it was the third Wednesday of the month at 8 a.m. But they left the 8 a.m. off the agenda. I saw that agenda when I went into the office on Saturday. And I called the mayor pro tem, whose number I had, and I said, go to City Hall, get that notice down, put the time on it, and repost it, and do it before 72 hours before the meeting. And he worked with the city manager to get that done so they could have that meeting on that Wednesday at 8 a.m. If no one had noticed until Monday, it would have been too late, and that meeting could not have happened. They would have had to have reposted for another time, no longer be a regular meeting, be a special meeting. And in that city, a special meeting has a supermajority requirement for a special meeting. That's not true in Kirby because of your home rule charter. But again, it needs to have the date and the time and the place and the subject of each matter. If the agenda posted does not contemplate action, the item we're on now, 6A, presentation, that's not an action word. I'm doing the presentation. That's the action. You're not taking any action today under item 6A. So look at the agenda. Most of the time, the city secretary will put on there discussion and possible action. That's all it has to say, but you need that action verb in order to take action. If the agenda has the wrong date, you don't have the meeting except on that date. So if this had erroneously said Sunday, May 16 at 9 a.m., we'd all be here tomorrow. We wouldn't be here now. There is a requirement that the notice be posted in a place accessible to the public at least 72 hours before the meeting. Most cities, some cities must, but most cities automatically also post it on their websites. Again, at least 72 hours before the meeting. If you can do it a little sooner than that, that's great, but the statute requires at least 72 hours of posting, except for certain emergency meetings, which are extremely rare. Pre-COVID-19, except for consultations with the attorney via like a conference call, meetings were in person. That means that the members of the governing body needed to be in the room. There was a very limited exception for emergencies where action needed to be taken, and one of the members of the governing body was out of the state and could only call in. There's a way to allow that under very limited circumstances. Under the governor's preemption of certain of the Open Meetings Act provisions due to the COVID-19 pandemic, those rules have been relaxed, and I'll be commenting on that in just a moment. The textbook for the Open Meetings Act is the Texas Attorney General's Open Meetings 2020 Handbook. It's about 140 pages long. It's available on the Attorney General's website. If you go to government and then click on the publication link, you'll see where you can look for and find that publication. I mentioned the COVID-19 preemption. Governor Abbott suspended various provisions of the Open Meetings Act due to the public health emergency last March, March of 2020. The suspension was effective March 16th of 2020. It continues until it is terminated by the governor or until his March 13, 2020 disaster declaration is lifted or expires. Since March of 2020, the governor has extended his disaster declaration on monthly occasions, usually in one-month increments. Most recently, the governor extended the emergency declaration on May 5, 10 days ago, and it's extended to June 4, 2021. The governor's office has indicated that For the foreseeable future, they expect the declaration to be continued on a monthly basis, and has indicated to the representatives of the Texas Municipal League that if that is not going to be the case, that the governor's office will endeavor to give some advance warning to governing bodies. Before the May 2020 extension, we were a little concerned that the second regular meeting of the Kirby City Council would have to be in person, even though it had been scheduled to be by teleconference. But the governor extended the emergency declaration in May of 2020, a day or two before our posting deadline for that meeting. Kirby did hold several meetings by teleconference in April and May of 2020, but then returned to in-person meetings like this one. Hopefully, with the number of people getting the vaccine and the CDC's new pronouncements about people being relatively safe or safer with having gotten the vaccine and 2 weeks out from their last vaccination, we can continue to have open meetings in open session in person like this for the foreseeable future. We had a few scares last summer and last fall, but I think hopefully we're all over that hump. But at any meeting these days, debrief a city council about roles and responsibilities and things of that nature, it's important to know about this unusual event. And so that's the quick summary. And when this suspension of the Open Meetings Act ends, then we'll be back to the way it was before March 16 of last year. There are some critical actions that the council has to take. Generally, some are on an annual basis, some are on an as-needed basis. And I wanted to kind of touch with you on what I see as the typical critical actions that you as a governing body will be considering and taking action on, probably in some cases that I'm going to mention next week, but in other cases over the summer and into the fall. The first critical action is the annual budget. That's something you'll do over the summer. It will be adopted most likely in late August or early September. There is a requirement to have a public hearing on your budget. You must act on the budget at the end of that public hearing. You don't have to adopt the budget at that meeting, but you have to do something. There has to be some action on the budget at the meeting where you hold the public hearing. That action can be to adopt the budget. That action can be to instruct staff to amend the budget and bring it back. That action can be to have another public hearing. But the statute, the local government code, Chapter 102, requires some action on the annual budget on the day you hold the public hearing. And you must adopt the budget before you set your annual tax rate. So both the preliminary budget and a final adopted budget are to be posted on the city website. The city manager and our finance director are the ones who prepare and create the annual budget with input from department heads and input from the governing body. There are often briefing meetings about the budget. Cities do it differently. Some cities, there are little subcommittees that are assigned subcommittees of the governing body, usually no more than two members of the governing body, who work with city staff, again with Tina or with Monique, with the finance director or the city manager, in regard to the budgets for public works in one case, or the police department and fire department in another case, administration in a third case. Sometimes there are briefings, workshops on the budget. It varies from city to city, and it varies from year to year, depending on local priorities and concerns. The annual tax rate is set after the budget is adopted, but is essentially determined during the budget process. In the 2019 legislature, 2 years ago, the legislature adopted Senate Bill 2, and it made significant changes to the way tax rates were set, what the process was, and it reduced the maximum increase in a tax rate that a city could adopt without having an election or being subject to an election. Before 2019's law change, a city could raise its budget, raise its tax rate by up to 8%, and there would be no opportunity for the citizens to have an election on whether to roll back that tax rate. If the city adopted a tax rate that was more than 8% over the prior year's tax rate, then the citizens could petition for a recall election, a rollback election on the tax rate. Under the new law, the city is going to adopt a tax rate with two components. One component is the maintenance and operations rate. That's the rate that is used and the funds that are raised to operate the city, to pay employees, to provide for support, equipment, whatever, for the administration, for the police department, the fire department, public works, the water department. That's the maintenance and operations rate. And the other part is a debt rate, the amount of taxes that have to be raised in order to retire long-term debt that the city has. Beginning in 2020, if a city adopts a tax rate where that maintenance and operations rate exceeds the prior year's rate by 3.5%, an election is mandatory with limited exceptions. In July of each year, the Bexar County Tax Assessor Collector determines what is called the voter-approved tax rate for each city, including Kirby, each city in the county. That rate is based upon the overall appraised value, last year's tax rate, and city debt. Essentially, for 2020, the voter-approved tax rate was a rate roughly equal to 103.5% of last year's rate, of the 2019 rate. In future years, this 3.5% factor might be higher, depending on tax rates adopted in prior years, and a proposed annual tax rate is essentially determined during the budget formation process because one of the main revenue items in the budget is the amount that staff projects being raised through the collection of property taxes. The City Council cannot adopt the tax rate on the same day as it holds the public hearing on the budget. It's in Chapter 102 of the Local Government Code. I can't explain why, just reporting and advising that you'll have to have a different meeting when you adopt your tax rate. In most years, the Kirby City Council has held the public hearing on its budget at its first regular meeting in September. And that's the meeting where you have to act on the budget, which in Kirby usually is, we're going to have another public hearing, and we're going to have another public hearing in 2 weeks, and we're going to act to adopt the budget at that next meeting in 2 weeks, and then adopts the budget at the second meeting in September. The tax rate is also considered and discussed at two meetings, but again, it's only adopted at the second meeting in September, because you have to first adopt the budget. Some cities are able, cities with smaller budgets than Kirby can accelerate this process, and they can hold their budget public hearing in August, adopt the budget in August, and then have all of the rest of August and September during which to adopt the tax rate. But I think historically, as our city manager and our city finance director will probably confirm, in Kirby, it's usually a two-meeting scenario in September. The first meeting, the budget public hearing, and the presentation of the proposed tax rate, and then at the second regular meeting in September, the adoption of the budget and the adoption of the tax rate.
Depending on when the second meeting in September falls, we try to do it on that meeting day.
And state law says the budget, if for almost all cities, the budget has to be approved by September 29th and the tax rate approved by September 30. There are certain few exceptions to that, but September 27th obviously is before either of those statutory deadlines. There are additional rules about time periods, notice requirements, and public hearings that city staff make sure that the we comply with during this process. All the operations of the city are driven by the budget. What y'all decide as a city council and as a governing body, what are the priorities? Once you identify the priorities, you also have the responsibility to figure out how you're going to pay for those implementation of those priorities. So one of the things on this agenda is to discuss council roles and responsibilities. One of the most important roles that you have is a policy role. When I'm done and we get out of item 6A and you move to item 7A, you're going to be discussing and taking possible action on establishing goals for the city. That's a policy action. That's a policy responsibility for the governing body, and an important one. Some cities are so busy doing the day-to-day mundane things that they never get around to talking about goals and responsibilities. And I think it's great that Ms. Vernon put on this agenda the opportunity for you to have a first discussion by this entire governing body on goals for the city of Kirby. Other important things that come up annually, an audit. This is done by an outside auditor. The city for many years has used the audit firm of Armstrong, Vaughan and Associates, whose offices are in Universal City. Armstrong Vaughan is probably the one accounting firm in our community that does more city audits than any other firm. And they're very familiar with the city's history and the city's finances. For the most part, city staff and city management have been comfortable with their services. The audit is usually done in the fall, because it's done after the close of the prior fiscal year, which is September 30, and presented to the City Council for action. My recommendation is the action on the annual budget is to accept it, not to approve it, because none of us, I don't think, on the governing body are certified public accountants. I'm not. I recommend that you accept the budget. You're accepting the work of your hired certified public accountant. You're not approving it, because I just feel like it's important to accept and not approve when I can't really, I don't have the skill set to know what exactly I'm approving. And I take the same position with other city councils. I take the same position on nonprofit boards where I sit, and I'm often the one making the motion on those nonprofit boards to accept the audit rather than to approve it. Things that come up more frequently than once a year, notices and public hearing on zoning changes, on variances, and on other matters where the city charter or state law require some action by the governing body. There are also going to be things you'll get. Often cities do this on a quarterly basis, which is to provide a report, usually a summary report, one or two pages, on city investments. Because in addition to the city's operating fund, the city has a water fund and other funds, a debt service fund, and it's important for the governing body to know the status of those funds and the status of city reserve dollars, which are invested. And the other thing you'll get, and it seems like in Kirby you get it at every meeting, is an update on city construction and public works matters. These are extremely important to the citizens. So citizens are here to hear the public works director report on the progress on construction in this area or that area, or the upcoming schedule or issues. Members of the governing body, y'all are out there every day in your community. You're seeing hopefully seeing action, sometimes seeing inaction by contractors. The meetings where you get these updates are opportunities for council members to give information to Public Works and to express the views of the governing body on those projects. Again, if it's an update and it doesn't say and possible action, it's just an update and there is no action to be taken. There are a few statutes that I always like to mention during a presentation like this, statutes that guide the work of the governing body and the work of the city. The city charter is the first thing on that list. That's your operating contract with the public. The Open Meetings Act, we've talked about in some depth this morning. The local government code controls various things about the city and city operations. The Public Information Act, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, tells the public what the public is entitled to request and receive and some of the procedures under that act. Because of the importance of streets and traffic, the transportation code often comes up in city council meetings, as well as the health and safety code, which deals with sanitation and nuisances, and of course the code of ordinances. I saw, I think the mayor has in front of her a notebook that said city ordinances or code of ordinances. That's the other Bible, so to speak. Begins with the city charter and has the various local ordinances adopted by this and prior councils that govern the operations and the things that go on in the city of Kirby. You have a number of commissions and committees. I'm going to speak about the four stated commissions or boards, and not about the ad hoc or not ad hoc but permanent committees, because they're not really codified. Under section 11.02 of the city charter, members of a city board or commission shall be registered voters of the city and reside in the city of Kirby. Under a holdover provision in the Texas Constitution, an appointed member of this governing body and of any of your commissions will serve until his or her successor is appointed and qualified. For the Planning and Zoning Commission, 5 members, 2-year terms, appointed by the City Council with staggered terms. The members select their chair and vice chair. The quorum is 3. The Zoning Commission makes recommendations to the City Council on zoning district changes, amendments to the wording of the zoning ordinances, on plats, and does a review of the city's comprehensive plan. Actions of the Zoning Commission and the City Council on zoning matters is discretionary. Action on plats by both the Zoning Commission and the City Council are not discretionary, meaning that if a plat or a replat of land in the city meets the statutory and ordinance requirements, it must be approved. There are strict time limits that can result in deemed approval of a plat or replat if it's not approved or denied within a certain amount of time. And in 2019, in an amendment to Chapter 212 of the Local Government Code on platting, the state legislature tightened up the time limits and put very difficult restrictions on city governments, such that a plat must be acted on by the governing body within 30 days of when it is presented to the governing body, must be acted on by the Zoning Commission first within 30 days of when it was filed with the city. And if those 30-day time limits are not met and day 31 happens, plat's approved. Doesn't matter how bad it is, doesn't matter what it says, it's deemed approved if it's not denied or conditionally approved within those 30-day limits. The most important 30-day limit, of course, being that of the governing body. And if you do deny a plat, you have to specify a statute, which can be a state law or a local ordinance, or in one case, a county regulation, which happened to apply, you have to specify why you're denying the plat. And you have to also, if you conditionally approve a plat, you have to state what the condition is, and the condition must be tied to a state statute or a local ordinance of some kind. You only get one bite at this apple. So I have a city which recently denied a plat for five stated reasons. The applicant came back within 2 weeks with its proposals to address those five stated issues. The statute required the city to hold a special meeting, because once the developer presented the responses to those conditions, the city council had 15 days within which to act to, again, either deny it, conditionally approve it, or approve it. If day 16 had happened with no action, that plat would have been approved in whatever shape, form, or manner it was. In this case, the city decided to conditionally approve the plat with three conditions that were stated in the resolution, tied again to specific sections of city or state law, in this case, one county regulation which applied. And so the developer now has an unlimited amount of time within which to bring those things to conclusion and get a final unconditional approval. The state law also says that on that first action by the governing body, you have to list everything that you're basing your denial on. You cannot come back later and add something to that list. So cities rely primarily on recommendations from their city engineer, sometimes with input from Public Works, sometimes with input from the city manager. But the city's professional on plats is usually the city engineer, who reviews them from an engineering standpoint as well as from the engineer's familiarity with the city's subdivision ordinance and zoning ordinance to the extent that it's applicable. The deadlines are important. The deadlines are different from what they used to be. The initial 30-day deadline has always been there. But the additional requirements about specifying on what basis a plat is denied or conditionally approved, the new 15-day deadline on considering a follow-up by the developer, need to not add anything afterward. So if the city engineer failed to mention something in the first go-round, it's too late on the second go-round to introduce a new objection to the plat. I spent a little bit more time on this because it's new. Cities are still getting used to it. And to make things even more interesting, the legislature is currently debating making more changes to the same statute. And the legislature will adjourn by constitution, I believe it's on May 31st, and we don't know yet what's going to come out of the session. Over 7,000 bills were introduced, and amendments to Chapter 212 of the local government are the subject of several amendments that are presently being looked at by the legislature. The next commission I want to mention to you is your Building and Standards Commission. This commission is considered quasi-judicial in that it has final city say on alleged violations of ordinances related to dangerous buildings and sanitation. The commission is to have 5 members, 4 alternate members appointed by the city council. Matters are often brought before the Building and Standards Commission by the city's code enforcement officer. There are detailed notice and hearing requirements. I think the processes of the Building and Standards Commission have become more formalized in recent years. My office, Mr. Fletcher of my office, has worked with the Building and Standards Commission on a number of substandard building conditions in recent years. And I think, although I don't have the agenda for your last meeting with me, I think that's one of the commissions where there are still some seats to be filled. Is that right, Ms. Vernon?
Alternate.
Yeah, okay. So that's an important body because they're your eyes and ears on making the community's appearance and safety and enhancing appearance and safety. So it's important to have all five, at least five members of that commission, whether they're the full members or an alternate sitting in, available and participate in each meeting. You have a Kirby Senior Center Corporation. This corporation was formed under Article 1528L of the Texas Civil Statutes and Chapter 394 of the Local Government Code. It operates the Senior Center on Allen Shepherd. It is a separate nonprofit local government corporation. It has a board of at least five, but not more than nine directors, each appointed by the City Council. All board members must be residents of the city. The City Council must approve any amendments to the corporation's articles of incorporation or bylaws. And if more than three members of the City Council attend a meeting of the center board, it will require separate notices, either a posted notice of the City Council or a notice of a possible quorum. It's my understanding from Ms. Vernon that three members of the City Council are currently on the Senior Center Board, and so caution must be exercised so that not more than four members of this governing body are present at a Senior Center Board meeting, unless there's a notice of a meeting posted or a notice of possible quorum. And if there's a choice, you post the notice of a meeting. And that has all these extra complications that I think should be avoided. Mr. Martin?
If that were to happen, how much time do we need to post it before the meeting? That there
72 be hours.
Okay. I just want to make sure it's the same.
Because there's so much interest in what's going on, I would suggest that the council consider whether it's appropriate to have three members of the council on the center board, whether it would be better to just have two members of the council on the board. I think that historically, members of the governing body began to be appointed to this board when there was a lack of participation, where there were not other folks in the community, non-members of the governing body, interested in serving. Mr. Salazar?
Yes, sir. What if, I don't always go to those meetings, but I have gone. So say I go and there's already three messages there. One of us has to decide to leave before that meeting starts.
That is correct. I've actually had that happen when I was chairman of a zoning commission in another city where we had, in that city, the quorum was three. And we had three members of the governing body come in for a zoning commission meeting, and someone discreetly asked one of them to please leave. It's an awkward conversation to have.
Right.
But,
for us, it shouldn't be because we don't want to be a violation of the law.
Right. Right, and if you have two or three members of the governing body on that commission, if there's something that needs to be brought to the City Council's attention, they can get with the mayor or with the city manager, and that can probably be put on an agenda for discussion at a City Council meeting. Well, it depends on how they post their meetings, but probably not.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about by Zoom.
I know, but if they post the meeting as an in-person meeting only, without the Zoom link being invited to participate via Zoom, then it would probably be okay. The real key is that a notice of possible quorum tells the public, y'all might be there. A notice of meeting means that you're going to talk. And it's the concern that I'm bringing to you is that you've appointed this board to be the oversight, the policy and management organization for the senior center. Let them do their work. And if there's a problem with their work, bring it to the attention of the mayor, the city manager, so the governing body can look into it and consider possible action. Every member of that board, just like every member of your zoning commission, every member of your building and standards commission, serve at the pleasure of the city council. So you can, as a council, take action to deal with a board where things aren't getting done in a way that meets the approval of the governing body. But you know, I just don't want to get a phone call on a Tuesday morning from Ms. Vernon, who tells me, well, we had five councilmen at the Kirby Senior Center board, and they all spoke up. Three of them are on the board, which was fine, but what about the other two? I don't want to have to answer that question. So, again, a word to the wise. Finally, the Kirby Crime Control and Prevention District. This isn't a commission. It's a district. It was created by a vote of the citizens, and it has a 7-person board of directors, again, appointed by the city council for staggered 2-year terms. By virtue of the election, the district receives sales tax revenue, and it is authorized to make expenditures consistent with the provisions of the governing statute, which is in Chapter 363 of the Local Government Code. Those expenditures are obviously for crime control and prevention. The city council must hold a public hearing on the district's annual budget. It gets to vote on approval or rejection of that annual budget, but that's all. You are not permitted, as a city council, to amend their budget. If you are not happy with their budget, you reject their budget, and it goes back to their board. There are some pretty tight time limits, different from a city budget, for the Crime Control and Prevention District's budget. They are hard to meet because they're just so long, so much lead time is required. Hopefully, you've never had a Crime Control District annual budget that was unsatisfactory, but your role as a city council is appointing the board of directors and voting to approve or not approve the annual budget, and you also get to vote on approval or rejection of any amendment that their board proposes to their budget. Other than that, they're autonomous. They spend that money. The city I represent right now with a crime control district just had its district spend a considerable amount of money to buy body-worn cameras for its police officers. That was strongly recommended by the police chief and the city staff, and was not an item in the city police department budget, but the Crime Control and Prevention District was able to find the dollars to get body-worn cameras and all the technological things that go with them, in line to be purchased within the next 60 to 90 days. Some other cities use the Crime Control and Prevention District to buy and replace police vehicles. It's an ability to use a small amount of sales tax revenue for a dedicated purpose, which enhances public health and safety, and takes some of the pressure off of the city budget. Moving to a few other matters, some things that commonly come up in discussions I've had with cities, both city councils and city managers. Can the city make a gift? No. Generally speaking, the city cannot give away city property. Any exception in regard to a gift is that you must justify, and I mean document in a formal way what the public purpose is for a gift. I discourage that. I had a city once wanted to give its street signs away when they were being replaced. And I said, you can't. You can sell them. You can even sell them at a discount. But you cannot give away public property. Employee bonuses. Often city councils want to recognize exemplary service by any number of employees and feel that that's an appropriate use of city dollars to provide a thank you and an incentive and to help people feel good about their jobs. Unfortunately, employee bonuses are generally not permitted unless you follow a very specific and very public policy describing the bonus, justifying why the bonus is being given, and it has to be done at an open meeting like this. So it's usually not done. You can enter into a contract with an employee with certain incentives, but you can't just change the deal. A bonus is considered to be payment for prior services, and that's what they got paid for already. Other times I'm asked, well, can we do this by resolution or do we have to do an ordinance? You need to do an ordinance to amend an existing ordinance. You need to do an ordinance about a zoning change because a zoning change is an amendment to the zoning ordinance. If you've got an ordinance now that covers nuisances and you want to add something to that, you do that by an ordinance. But you don't have to do an ordinance to enter into a contract. Many cities do interlocal agreements, for example, on public safety or on other things. And those can be done by resolution. They don't have to be done by ordinance. What risk does the city have if it does something? There is a statute that is called the ratification statute, which says that actions by the city council must be challenged in court within 3 years of adoption or the actions are presumed valid. There are a few exceptions to that, but generally speaking, most things that you'll do as a city council, once 3 years have elapsed, it's too late to challenge them. They're presumed valid, and you just move on. As I say, there are a few exceptions to that which don't need to go into now. Competitive bidding. With certain exceptions, any expenditure of more than $50,000 from city funds is to be done by a competitive sealed bid process with notice of the city's request for competitive sealed bids being published along with a time and place at which bids will be opened, and that publication has to be done at least once a week for two consecutive weeks in a newspaper published in the city. Contracts can be awarded on the basis of determining not just the low bid, the lowest bid, but by the bidder, determining the bidder who provides goods or services at the best value to the city. This does not always mean the lowest cost, and the city should consider not only price, but reputation of the bidder, the quality of the bidder's goods or services, the bidder's past relationship with the city, references, among other factors. There are a number of exceptions where you don't need to go through a competitive bidding process. The ones that come up most frequently are professional or personal services, planning services, procurements of items from only one source, procurements necessary to protect the public health and safety of city residents, procurements through buy boards, which are organized by other public entities and go ahead and vet vendors and get lowest prices. Procurements necessary due to unforeseen damage to public machinery, equipment, or other property. All of those are exceptions. So if you've got a problem with a water tower and it's affecting the city's water supply and it's going to cost $95,000, you don't have to competitively bid it and take 4 weeks to get it bid out. that's probably a public emergency, and you can move forward on a much quicker basis. Primary responsibility for making sure that this law is complied with the city manager, and to a lesser extent with department heads. But these awards, any award of this size is going to be coming before the council. So if someone brings something to the council with a cost of more than $50,000, it's definitely a fair question to ask, was this competitively bid? If the answer is yes, fine. If the answer is it's through a buy board, fine. If the answer is it was an emergency and this is the emergency, it's fine. But if somebody comes and wants to spend $95,000 on something that doesn't fit into one of those exceptions and there wasn't competitive bidding, send it back for competitive bidding. Yes, ma'am.
I hate to interrupt you. Is it possible that we could take a break?
Of course. Just say we're doing a recess till X time.
We will take a recess and reconvene at 10:30.
Thank you. So to continue, I just have two last areas to discuss. I mentioned the Public Information Act several times this morning, so I want to spend a few more minutes kind of giving you some background. Again, for the new members of the governing body who haven't done so, there is another video to see. It's another hour-long video from the Attorney General's office. It has actors in it. They are somewhat entertaining at times, but it's, again, something you should watch. I don't think Kirby has done this. Another city I represent actually delegated to the city secretary the duty to be the public information officer, and by doing so, only she had to watch the video. But I don't think Kirby has done that, and even if you have, I encourage you to watch the video. I think it will help you understand more about how the Public Information Act works, and the kinds of things that Ms. Cox and Ms. Vernon have to deal with on a regular basis so the city stays in compliance with state law. Same thing, it's on the AG's website. There used to be a DVD or a CD. Get with Ms. Cox for more information. There is a presumption under the Public Information Act that city records and documents are open to the public. But at the same time there is that presumption, there are roughly 60 specified exceptions to that rule. The Public Information Act is in Chapter 552, 552 of the Texas Government Code. The exceptions to disclosure include, and I'm not going to list all 58 or 60 of them, anything that's related to a law enforcement matter, a pending investigation, or a closed investigation where certain things have occurred are potentially not subject to public release. There are protections against things concerning common law privacy. There's a seminal case from the Texas Supreme Court that lists some of the things that are considered intimate or embarrassing matters which are not releasable by a city. These are no way can you release something that violates someone's common law privacy or something that is embarrassing or sensitive information that falls in the categories described by the Supreme Court decision. Juvenile criminal matters are not subject to release. The home addresses, home telephone numbers of city employees who timely request privacy, not subject to release. More information, not just home phone numbers and home addresses, but things like whether a police officer has a spouse or children, are protected from disclosure, whether the police officer specifies it or not. Those are pretty much automatic. Driver's license numbers, license plate numbers, vehicle ID numbers, social security numbers, all not subject to release to the public. Account numbers, not available, not to be released to the public. If someone wants a copy of a filing fee check that they gave to the city, if it wasn't their check, you cannot give them a complete copy of the check because the check has an account number on it. If someone asks for a copy of a city check used to pay the newspaper, cannot give them a copy of the city check without redacting the account number. The account number is not subject to release. Personal email addresses of folks who send emails to the city, not subject to release. Military discharge forms, not subject to release. The psychological examination reports of potential police officers, not subject to release. A lot is subject to release. Those aren't the only exceptions. Those are the ones I see most of the time. The other things I see a lot of the time are anything that's an attorney-client communication, not subject to release. Certain information about competitive bidding, not subject to release at a certain time. Maybe subject to release after a contract is awarded, but until a contract is awarded, the bids are not public information. The city secretary is your public information officer. Any public information requests should go to the city secretary, route it to the city secretary. Sometimes the police department gets public information requests, and those can be handled internally at the police department or referred to the city secretary. But the same rules apply, whether it's to the city secretary or the PD. If the PD receives a request for a police report and it's got someone's date of birth in it, and it's not the date of birth of the requesting person or the requesting person's spouse or minor child, that date of birth needs to be redacted. Most of the time, we have to send a letter to the Office of the Attorney General asking Mother, may I withhold this information? There are exceptions to that. We don't have to send that letter if all we're redacting is vehicle information or a social security number or an account number. But for most other information, we need to send a letter to the Office of the Attorney General asking for authority or permission to redact or withhold. Records of our municipal court are not covered by the Public Information Act. They are covered by an administrative rule issued by the Office of Judicial Administration in Austin, and they are under the jurisdiction of the municipal judge. There are different rules for municipal court records. Information that the city can release if it's in a police report, the municipal court cannot release if it's on a traffic citation. I can't explain the inconsistency. I can only tell you it exists. Under Senate Bill 944, which is adopted 2 years ago, each member of the city council is a temporary custodian of public information created or received by you, even if it's on your personal cell phone, iPad, or other device. The statute states that a council member does not have a personal property right to public information created or received while acting in an official capacity. And you must surrender that public information to the city, typically to the city secretary, within 10 days of request, whether it's on a city-owned device or your personally owned device. I think you all have city iPads. Almost all of you, I'm sure, have city phones or have your own personal phones. Doesn't matter whether it's your phone or the city's phone, your iPad or the city's iPad. If it's got city information on it, it's subject to the release under the Public Information Act. This means that you need to be especially careful about what you do on social media. Your life is an open book. on social media. If you post something about this meeting, it's public information. If you post something about what was done at last Thursday night's meeting, it's public information. Even if you post, I saw the crew not working on such and such a street when we're paying them to work, it's public information. Do what we tell our kids to do. If you want to keep it private, don't put it on social media. Assume the worst. And I know I'm lecturing. I didn't get to give this speech to my kids because I'm too old. We didn't have social media then. This is my chance, people. But seriously, it's easy to post and it's not easy to erase. Once it's out there, it's out there. And we all need to just remember that. So I think a word to the wise, and maybe more than a word, was all I'll do here. The last thing I want to cover.
One thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, they do fit together. You know, this Facebook, I think we all know about Facebook. Nextdoor, which I asked Ms. Vernon if y'all have Nextdoor in Kirby, is I think relatively new. People seem to be just so uninhibited with what goes on. I mean, we get Nextdoor postings from neighborhoods miles away from where we live about a lost dog here and who was up so late that their music was playing so loud in neighborhoods like 10 miles away from where I live, and they're coming in on my Nextdoor account. I'm wondering, maybe you people should find something else to do. But all of those things add up, and all of those things can be public information, subject to release. And, you know, what I think people tell their kids are, if you don't want everyone to know what you're saying, don't say it. And it's hard to do. It's hard to police ourselves. Mike?
But this has to be related to city business.
Yes, yes. But as Council, as County Commissioner Atkinson told me, his private cell phone is public information. What we can do in that instance, I once had a public information request for the phone bill for a person's private cell phone. And we sent that request to the Attorney General's office for a ruling, because most of the phone numbers called were to family members and were nothing about city business. I mean, who's picking up the kids today? Are you going to the softball game? You know, is mom out of the hospital? That kind of stuff. And so we asked the Attorney General, can we redact the non-public related numbers? And we were told we couldn't. But still, it's time-consuming. Sending letters to the Attorney General take time and cost money. I think most cities, and I think Kirby is one of them, want to provide public information to the public when they can. Send me this stuff and say, do we have a ruling on this? And I have to say yes. And so we send it off for a ruling, and that can delay response for as much as 60 days, because the Attorney General's office has 45 business days within which to respond to a city's request for a ruling under public information. The city must send that request within 10 business days for most information. The rules are different for body-worn camera recordings of police officers, where we have a little bit more time to make the request. These are time sensitive, and so it is important, if a member of the governing body gets a public information request, to immediately get it to the city secretary so that it can be put in the queue to be acted on in the timely way that Ms. Cox operates. And I thank Ms. Vernon for the clarification about
responding to postings, because that's sort of like responding to emails. And a lot of times when I send an email out to a government body, I put a footer on it that says, please do not reply at all. Please only discuss the matters concerning city business in an open, properly noticed open meeting with the governing body. And most of the time, that's obeyed. I won't say it all the time. The last thing I was going to talk about this morning, and then, as I said at the beginning, I'm glad to hear if there are any other questions that have been asked during the talk, is Chapter 171 of the Local Government Code. This section, this chapter, deals with conflicts of interest as set out by the legislature. It sets out the rules for when an elected or appointed official must file an affidavit and not participate in discussion or vote on certain matters. There are two kinds of interests that you may have that could result in your needing to file an affidavit. One interest is an interest in real estate with a value of at least $2,500. So essentially, your home or your business, if you own your business location. Another interest is a business interest if you own over 10% of the business, or you own over $15,000 in value of the business, or the business is one from which you derive at least 10% of your income in the prior year. If a matter comes before the city council, which would have a special economic effect upon you based upon the value of your home, different from the value of other people's homes, or if that item involves something that would have an impact on your business, again, with a special economic impact on your business that doesn't affect somebody else's business, then you'll need to file an affidavit setting out what the issue is and what the matter before the council is, and not participate or vote in the matter. By not participating, that means you either not at the meeting or you don't speak during the meeting and you don't vote on the issue. The same requirement applies if your spouse, your child, or your parent has the requisite real estate or business interest. For example, if a zoning or planning matter comes before the city council and one of your children lives within 200 feet of the property that is the subject of the zoning change or planning, you should plan to file the affidavit and not participate in the vote on the matter. When I was on the zoning commission in another city, a zoning case was coming up on a piece of property a quarter of a mile from my house, separated by a four-lane state highway from my house, but had the street address of my street. I attended a legal conference, a real estate law conference, and the chairman of the Texas Ethics Commission spoke at that conference, and he said that it is his advice to the city council person that if there is a zoning case in their subdivision, there's a zoning case in their subdivision, they should recuse themselves from voting on that zoning case because of this statute. So, not knowing better, I went up during the break and asked him about the case I was about to hear as a zoning commission, and explained that a quarter of a mile from my house, but on the same street, and separated from my house by the four-lane state highway. He said to me, if I were you, I would refuse myself. Figuring that if there was ever a repercussion, and it came out that the chairman of the state ethics commission suggested I refuse myself, probably be a good idea. 2 o'clock at about a 7 o'clock council meeting. Oh, Councilman Jones forgot to tell me, but this zoning case about this business is around the corner from his house. What does he do? I said, I'll send you an affidavit, have you come in 15 minutes before the city council meeting, have you sign the affidavit, your notary, notarize it, and remind him to stay quiet on the dais from the side of the council. And it works. It worked fine. It's better to get a little bit more notice. I'm glad to prepare these affidavits. I'm glad to work through Ms. Vernon to help determine whether it's necessary. But there are criminal penalties if you violate this statute. So if you do have a question about that, please refer to Ms. Vernon, and she will get with me, or she'll have me contact you directly. In order to do the affidavit, I've got to describe what the conflict is. So I have to say that, you know, there's a matter before the city council involving a piece of property in Alan Shepherd, and I, so-and-so councilman, live within so many blocks or so much distance from that. I use 200 feet in my example because that's the notice provision for a zoning change. So if you got a, if you get the certified mail or the regular mail notice of a zoning change, that's a pretty good tip off that you better recuse yourself. But it's not the only tip off. I mean, I can get a notice about the zoning change a quarter of a mile from my house. But I felt after hearing that talk that it would be prudent to just make sure. And I'm glad to do that, and I'm done, except for any questions y'all have. If there are no questions, then I'm going to turn the meeting back over to Mayor Aldridge, and we can move back to the second one.
Are there any questions for our attorney?
Thank you.
I have a question. Sorry, I have a question. Just to go back about the Zoom or calling in for meetings for us, council. So I know you said right now because COVID, the guidelines, we can do that. But let's say, I don't know, next month, you know, the governor, they change it. So can we still, if I'm out of state, can I call in?
The answer is maybe.
Okay.
Let me explain, maybe. First of all, for this meeting, with this agenda posted, no.
Okay.
No. If a council member wants to come in and participate in a meeting by Zoom, we got to say it. We got to tell everybody that's possible. There is an exception if it's an emergency. There's a very limited exception in the Open Meetings Act. I don't want to have you watch me read. But I'm glad to look it up and send something to Ms. Vernon next week. But there's a very limited exception, for a council person to participate by telephone, even if it's not on here, even if it's not a pandemic. Okay? But if it's going to be Zoom and it's going to be open to a councilman by Zoom, it's got to be open to everybody by Zoom, even under the governor's statute. The reason I said maybe is there's a bill right now in the legislature. It's already passed. I can't remember now whether it's passed the Senate or the House, but it's passed one of them, so it's still alive. That bill would continue the Zoom opportunity indefinitely, pandemic, no pandemic, emergency order, no emergency order. Because of the way the legislature works, and I'm not going to do legislation 101 because it's not here, it's relevant only to the prescriber's question. But if a bill has not passed either the Senate or the House by today, it's dead. Unless you can somehow find a way to amend another bill that has passed one or the other houses of the state legislature. And the legislature adjourns on May 31. There's an old trick they use. I don't know if they still use it. It may be urban myth. But there's a rumor that the clock in the legislative chamber stops at 11:59 on the last day of the session, mysteriously. And because the clock hasn't struck midnight, they keep going until they're done. I don't know if that's true or not. I wouldn't be surprised if it is. But because of the rules that the State House of Representatives and the State Senate have approved, a bill has to have passed one of them by this time in the session being adopted and put on the governor's desk. And even if they do pass a bill, the governor has 20 days within which he can sign it, veto it, or do nothing. And Governor Abbott has vetoed bills. The percentage of vetoed bills is pretty low. But nobody knows what the governor will do until he does it. There was a bill passed on May 5th involving cyber security training. Y'all are going to have to do cyber security training if you haven't done it by June 14th or 15th of this year. There's a bill in the legislature to modify how that all works. It's on the governor's desk. It's passed the House and the Senate. And I think the governor has 20 days, so he has until May 25th, to act on it. Similarly, the bill that would make more permanent the ability for council members and other board members to participate and even vote on matters coming before the council or their board via Zoom or via telephone has passed one of the legislative bodies and is pending soon before a committee in the other one. And so it's possible it will pass, and we'll know more roughly, you know, by June 20th or 21st, we'll know what bills are going to become law or have become law. The cyber security bill, which I think House Bill 1118, passed by such a margin that if Governor Abbott signs it, becomes effective on signing. Most bills become effective on September 1, 90 days after the close of the legislative session. September 1, August 31. But some bills state that if they're passed by super majorities in the House and in the House and Senate, can become effective on the governor's signature. And so if Governor Abbott signs the cybersecurity bill, the rules change immediately on who's subject to cybersecurity training and additional requirements for cities to certify about the employees and council members getting the training. So I'm sorry I had to say maybe. I didn't mean to be disrespectful, but that's where we are right now. If there's no change in the law, the governor cancels or kills the emergency declaration, we're back to live in person, no Zoom, no telephone, except with limited exceptions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I got one more question. Back to the cybersecurity, you know, we had to do the video last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are we still required to do that every year? Or?
Yes, so right now you have to do it again, and I'll be getting that notice out.
Everybody?
Anybody who uses any type of city device, you get on our network, you use city email, you have to take it every year. And I have to certify by June the 15th that all of our employees and council have taken it. So I'm going to, this time, instead of you all coming in, I'm going to send everybody the link, and you can do it on your own and submit to me the paperwork. And you do have to do it.
Monique, does it have to be that training?
No. If you have done another cybersecurity training, you're within this year, this time frame, you can submit proof of that.
Okay.
But you do have to do one.
So what we did in November or whatever, we just resubmit that?
So you have to do it this year. It'll have to be 2021. So if you did it in November, that counted for last year. You're going to have to do it again.
Chris, change the date.
Yeah. So I'll get that out to everybody. It's just a YouTube video that you can watch.
That was 3 hours long.
No, not the cybersecurity one. That one was only maybe 20 minutes.
Right.
You're probably thinking about
FEMA.
Yeah, the NIM stuff, all your FEMA. Once you've taken that once, you don't have to do that again.
Okay.
Hattie's given a memo to our new council members with a list of the trainings that you have to take for the NIM. But yeah, you don't have to do that again.
Okay. That's what I want.
Yeah, no, just the cybersecurity is annual. And then just a couple other things, if you don't mind, that I wanted to just touch on. One, I know Mr. Shaw mentioned that, you know, you all could, if there's questions for him throughout the year. So I'm going to ask that, you know, you let me know or let the mayor know if you want to make contact with him rather than people just reaching out to him directly because it costs us by the hour. question, but the other thing, I know he touched on like the dealings with personnel. So if a council member has a question about the department or employees, you make those appointments to come see me, or you call to talk to me about those rather than going directly to employees or departments with inquiries. And then you all have a copy of this document. It's the newly elected city officials orientation that's hosted by TML. And so anyone who's interested in going to that, they're going to host a session July 29th and 30th in downtown San Antonio. It's all day on that Thursday, half a day on Friday. If you will please let me know if you would like to attend, and the city will register you. We pay for that fee. It's $195 for TML members, which each of you are TML members as a Kirby City Council person. And so that includes, I believe, the meals as well. So the sooner you let us know, the better. That way we can get you registered for that.
Appear or we it's called censoring, or basically where like you kind of like silence a member of council or something like that. I was reading on something. I noticed another city that did something on a council member. They couldn't speak on something anymore. Can you, like, do we bring that up at a meeting, or do we just go to the city? Like, how does that work? And then also, too, can we vote a council person off?
Well, the last part of your question, the answer is no. You cannot vote a council person off.
Okay.
We have an electorate. The electorate makes that decision. The citizens are the ones who make the decision who sits up there and who doesn't. And there's mechanisms for that, including May 1st, or the first Saturday of every May. As far as censure is concerned, C-E-N-S-U-R-E, that is something that city councils sometimes do in order to, as a group, make it clear to another member of the council that they found certain conduct to be reprehensible or inappropriate in some pretty serious way. And you can't just do it when it happens, because, again, the Open Meetings Act says date, time, place, subject for every meeting. So if a council person, Mr. or Ms. X, does something that another council person feels was just beyond the pale, reprehensible, they can ask the city manager or the mayor to put on an agenda, hopefully one fairly quickly after this, whatever awful conduct it is, discussion and possible action on censure of X for Y. Pretty strong thing to do. I don't recommend it. There are hopefully other ways to address conduct, but that is the answer to your question.
Is that a regular vote of four? Does that require a supermajority?
No, I think it's unless the charter would require a supermajority for that, it's a majority. But hopefully, not just rare, but very rare. Hopefully, that doesn't come up, but it can. It certainly can.
Again, would that be related to city business or anything?
I think it's not relevant for the city council to punish, reprimand, censure for something unrelated to the city. The voters can still do that, but I think if censure by the city council ought to be something related to the city. It just seems to make sense.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark, for that presentation. I will now open up 7A, discussion and possible action on establishing goals for the city of Kirby.
So you all have a copy of what is entitled City of Kirby Texas Implementation Plan. This was for fiscal year 2019-2020. And this is something that we annually review to determine if the goals that we set for the city change. And then there are different action steps and tasks for them. So this is just kind of a guide to give you an idea. We need to update that for this fiscal year. If you want to continue doing it this way, if you wanted to handle them differently, that's fine as well. But it's basically six goals. The first one is to enhance city appearance, and that's through beautification and code compliance. The second one is to promote economic development. We talked about ways of doing that through boundary adjustments and business retention. The third goal is to improve our workplace environment through recruitment and retention of talented employees. Goal number four is to provide proactive maintenance and improvement to our infrastructure, and that related to streets mostly. And goal number five is to actively seek and obtain grants. And goal number six is to improve community involvement. So those have been, for the last 4 years, the six goals that the council asked us to focus on. So today is, again, will be an opportunity for you to decide if these are the same, if you'd like to remove anything, add anything, and then what we would do is go well. What we tried to do is also list what employee or entity or department was responsible for the different action steps and then update the status on those. And at one point we were doing that quarterly, so it'll be up to this council to decide how you want to get those updates as to where we are on those items.
Monique, is this something that we have to decide today, or can we get back to you?
No, we can get back to it. It's just kind of to begin that discussion today.
I would ask council members to look over this.
So it needs to be on as an agenda item before we talk about it, right?
Well, you can discuss it. If you're going to take some action changes, like you know, that has to be officially voted on.
Right, right. I would think each of us should take a look at this and decide what we want to continue, add, and then come back to this. So to bring it back as an agenda, or Monique, should each council member contact you and say, hey, I'd like to do this, and then bring it, change the document, and then bring it back as an agenda item?
We can do it that way if you want. If council members have input they'd like to send me or talk to me about, then I can compile all of that, and then when you have another agenda item, you all can discuss it and decide what to add or what to remove.
I mean, I personally think that would be better. Does anybody else have any ideas?
That would be the easiest way to do it, because there may be a bunch of ideas, but you don't do it at one time.
It's more logical, because, I mean, just to put it in front of you like this, to make a decision, I think it's better than sitting there looking.
I've never seen this before, so
I'd
like to look over it.
Yeah, no, we've
got all the same thing. And obviously, there's things on here that are done, so,
it's going to come back up.
We have modified that, and we should be good to go. We have to act on that.
Really, we're just going to bring ideas to the items, right?
Yeah. Right, and really, my biggest thing today is, are those six goals that this council wants us to continue focusing on? And the reason that's important is because, like, we can change these tasks under each one, all year long.
Right.
But the main goals is what drives our budget also. Right. And so, as we know, we're about to start budget season in June. We will have our first budget workshops at 6 p.m. at both June council meeting dates. So we'll budget workshop at 6, regular meeting at 7. So the way we handle budget, for those who are new is, I ask the department heads to put together kind of their wish list, as we call it, things that they need in their department for that fiscal year, realizing that we won't be able to afford them. And in those workshops, we'll divide it up, and like maybe two departments will present the first meeting and the other the second meeting, to talk about what are the capital items they need, what are the other purchases they're requesting. And then I ask council to kind of categorize those things as to what you feel you would support and would not support. Then we go and build our budget based on. But so having those goals helps us to understand, what is this council's main focus going to be? Is it going to be cleaning up the city? Then we know, okay, these are some items that the staff would recommend to do that. So is it going to be economic development? And again, these have been pretty much the same for the last 4 years. Those have been the main issues in our city. But you may have different ones that you're recommending. So we just need to know that.
Is there any more discussion on this issue?
So we're going to put this on the next agenda, or can we wait? How long do you want to wait before we start looking at it?
I would say if we could all look at this and get back to Monique with your additions and your ideas, I would say by the next council meeting. By the first meeting in June.
There you go.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes. And then she can compile the information and bring it back we can bring it back as an agenda item for a list.
So this is for, I'm sorry, I just want to clarify. So this is, these goals also tie into our budget, but I thought our budget, we're going to be discussing that in June, so we don't need to discuss any of this before
the budget in June? I'm confused.
Just start the process.
Yes.
Okay.
We're just going to start the process.
What will happen in June is it'll be discussion. So we can merge all of this discussion in together about the goals and how we build the budget to meet those goals. And then by July, we will have to start having the budget on paper to get direction on finalizing it. For me, the best case scenario would be don't wait until you come in here on June 10th to tell me what you're suggesting. Read it and send it to me or come and see me so we can talk about it in advance so I can have it all compiled to give everybody for the June 10th